This is the IBJ podcast for the week of November the 8th, 2021, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. We have seen a lot of big numbers connected to home sales this year as a confluence of factors have driven up home prices. I'm going to cherry pick one because it is big and round and actually represents three decades of work in the Indianapolis residential real estate market. The number is $1 billion. The real estate agent is Matt McLaughlin of the F.C. Tucker Company. Over 32 years, he has represented more than 2,300 clients in either buying or selling homes. The total value of those transactions, again, recently exceeded $1 billion. McLaughlin is a local guy who grew up in Meridian Kessler, who went to Chatard High School and then Ball State. He started with Tucker at 27, and his acumen for real estate was obvious from the beginning. He was Tucker's Rookie of the Year right out of the gate with 22 transactions. Now, let's fast forward to 2020. The Matt McLaughlin team, which includes a modest support staff, closed 132 transactions worth $86 million. He is perennially among the top-selling agents in the Indianapolis area in IBJ's annual ranking of all-star agents in terms of total sales volume, and his longevity has taken him to this rare milestone. Again, he has a support team of several licensed real estate associates, but Matt is directly responsible for the vast majority of transactions for the team. For this week's edition of the podcast, we asked him to share his take on the current market, his approach to helping clients with some of the biggest financial transactions of their lives, how to break bad news when necessary, why he considers himself to be an old school broker, and to share a few war stories. Here's our conversation. I am happy to welcome to the podcast Matt McLaughlin, a realtor and broker with F.C. Tucker. He is the head of the team Matt McLaughlin and Associates. Hey, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Sure, at any time.
I want to take you back, if I could, beginning here to 1989, which I believe is when you began working with the Tucker Company.
Yes.
Do you remember the first transaction that you were involved in?
I don't. I have a general idea that when you're doing a transaction, you're doing multiple transactions throughout the year. So I don't know really which one was the first, but I had several going at the same time. I had been buying and selling a few homes on my own. So maybe that is the reason why I don't remember.
How old were you when you started at Tucker at 89?
27.
And why did you decide to take that path?
Well, I was working for a family business, and I'm the youngest of six boys. And it doesn't matter how old you are, you're always the youngest, so no one really listens to you. So I always had an interest in real estate, and I had been, like I said, buying and selling a few homes for myself to buy, move into, rent, or flip. At that time, it really wasn't anything flipping, but I would sell it, move on to another one. And I just had an interest in real estate, always have since I was a kid, and liked that aspect of it and kind of the Monopoly, playing Monopoly. That's how I got started.
Did you play Monopoly as a kid?
All the time.
Were you a whiz kid at Monopoly? Did you start beating your brothers and sisters?
Was not, you know, I don't know. I think I made my fair share. Being the youngest, you're always trying to beat everybody, to keep up with everybody.
Do you share my strategy that the orange properties are a must-have?
They are a must-have. Your little cheap ones are the best ones to start with.
Right.
They always get everybody as you're turning the corner.
There you go. Now, I saw on your resume that you went to Chatard High School.
I did.
So did you grow up in the Meridian Kessler area?
I did. I grew up in Meridian Kessler, 45th and Central, or 44th Street between Penn and Washington. That's where my parents had their kids, and my dad grew up there. And so we just kind of stayed in the area, and I stayed in the area until about 7 years ago when we moved to our current home, which is outside of Meridian Kessler.
If I went back to 1989 and told you that your total sales volume would reach $1 billion within 32 years, would that have even seemed conceivable?
Well, it's kind of hard to really truly figure out what $1 billion really is. And till you've done it for 32 years. And then you kind of, you know, the grunts and groans of making it happen, you know, makes it realize that it's possible.
Does this milestone mean anything in particular to you? Is it meaningful, or is it, I mean, essentially trivia?
Well, I'm not a big accolade person. It doesn't make me who I am or doesn't get me excited. My mother always calls and said, I hear you had an ad in the paper, you had a milestone in the paper, and why didn't you say anything? And, you know, I don't know if it's kind of the way I was brought up, because I was the youngest and, you know, you just really didn't, you just kind of were told to sit there and do what you're supposed to do. And, you know, don't sit and toot your own horn, but I'm not real good at that. And don't really, it's fine for those that like it. I just keep my blinders on and keep working.
Yeah. You don't seem like the kind of guy that had like a thermometer on your office wall with $1 billion on top of it. And you've been tracking it.
No, have not been tracking it. And I really didn't even know until my managers came to me and told me that they were about ready to close on it in the next month with looking at what I had in the pipeline.
What neighborhoods did you primarily work in the beginning?
In the beginning, I would probably do a little bit of everything. I think at the age of 27, when I was doing it, most of my friends had gotten out of school and had rented and then decided to buy. And that's kind of where I just kind of navigated towards that first-time home buyer or for sale by owners. I also worked a lot with open houses. Whomever would work with me, I'd work with them. I had a little bit of an advantage, I think. I had gray hair when I was 27, which was all white at that point in time. In high school, I had probably more gray hair than you have right now. You know, I think that lended a little help in the believability in the trust department. I didn't look like I was 27 or 25 or, you know, just getting started in the business.
You know, you still have a good amount of hair left.
I do.
Now, what is your niche right now, if it's fair to say that you have one? Are you primarily in the high-end or luxury homes, or is it all over the board still?
You know, I'll do just a little bit about anything. So I don't discriminate on my price range, because honestly, it probably is a quicker opportunity to sell five $200,000 homes than it is to sell $1 million home. And when you get into the higher price ranges, the commissions are a little bit less, so you make more money and they move quicker. So I've never been one to say, no, I'm not interested in this, because it's really too inexpensive. So I help friends, I help my friends' kids, I help, you know, whoever wants it. I'll do just about anything.
Now, my understanding is that this last year has been an extreme outlier for residential real estate in a market that is stacked heavily in favor of the seller. Have you seen anything like this year in your career?
No, it's never been like this. And it's always been a little bit where it's been harder supply-wise, maybe has been less, not to the degree that it is right now. I think that a lot of it is not necessarily favored in the seller as much as, well, I guess it is because they're the one that's benefiting. But I think we're resetting our values on our properties. I don't feel like it's a bubble that's going to burst. We've been in an area that has never had super high price ranges. You know, if you go to Atlanta, you go to the coast, you go, you know, a $2 or $3 million house is every other house. Here, $2 million house is a big deal to try to get sold. So I think it's reset our markets. It's pushed us up over that $2 to $3 million mark. And, you know, when you didn't hear about a $4 million sale, there's been several. And so I think our market is catching up to those other major metropolitan areas that are, I think we really compete with those. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be there.
And again, I think, as you mentioned, there's a real supply and demand dynamic. I think I've heard that there is just much less product available. Am I reading that correctly? And if so, why is that?
If I knew that, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you. But my opinion of that is that, let's say 10 years ago, there were, or even before 2008, because that was kind of really the slowdown when individuals were doing, anybody could borrow money and there could be builders doing spec building. And so there were a lot of custom builders doing spec building. There were production builders doing spec building. So you had all of this supply happening on a spec scenario. We don't have that now. We have the custom builders are only doing contracts. You might find one or two that are doing a few specs here and there, but nothing at the rate that they used to. And now we've gone to a lot of production built homes where they are doing and trying to make up the difference for the two. But also it's so expensive to build that there's production builders that used to be $300,000 to $500,000 are now $800,000 to $1 million. So, you know, you can go and get a production built home for $1 million very easily. And there just isn't that lower price range of that $500,000 to $700,000 and readily supply that there was before. So people are not going to, they don't have anywhere to go. So they're going to stick around until they can find the right thing, which then you don't have the supply for the first time. And you got first time buyers coming and they're grabbing everything and more buyers than they are sellers.
Okay, let's take a quick break so we can hear from our sponsor, Taft. This is the IBJ podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 625 attorneys across 11 offices, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ podcast, and we're talking with Matt McLaughlin, an FC Tucker real estate agent who recently passed $1 billion in sales.
How has this dynamic changed your job this year?
I don't know that it's changed it much because I've always been a pretty diligent worker and work a lot. So that part hasn't changed as much. It's just when you're trying to negotiate an offer, you know, when you were just working with the seller, you know, as a buyer working with the seller, seller's agent, you'd get a deal done. Well, now you're competing with 3 to 5 to 7 offers at a time. And so you're losing out. So that's the difference for me is I'm losing out where I never lost out before. I don't like to lose.
Wow. I never thought of it that way. How do you keep from losing?
You make a very good offer. You know, maybe you go over, maybe you over the list price, maybe you offer an escalation clause, maybe you do an as-is addendum where you will not ask for any repairs, but you're going to have an inspection, but still not ask for any repairs just for informational purposes so that, let's say that there you come up with a foundation problem, you can at least walk away. Some people, I don't suggest it, but some people have just waived the right to an inspection period. Sellers can kind of write their ticket right now. So you might have a new listing come up and say, listings showing start on Friday. We will take all offers up till noon on Sunday and we'll respond by Sunday at 8 o'clock. Seller would like to stay in the house for 15 days after closing rent free. They would like to close on this date. So they're giving all their preliminaries up front. So you as the buyer then match those as best you can and try to see if there's any other incentive that you can give them as well. That's how you don't lose out. And knowing other brokers who are on the other end, if you have a good reputation. So I have had many houses that have had multiple offers and you look at the broker as who's representing the buyer and you look back in your mind and you think, okay, have I had a good transaction with them or not? Do they make it to the goal line? You know, there's a little bit more to the job than everybody thinks. So from A to Z and everything in between, can this broker get that done? And are they telling you the truth?
That's fascinating. That actually leads into another question I had about brokers. I mean, I think that when people think about real estate brokers, the general public thinks about real estate brokers, you know, they tend to see the image that is on the sign. Everybody looks very friendly. Everyone looks very approachable, like clean cut, honest. That seems like the baseline. But what particular skill do you have, do you think, that has served you the best over your career? Is there something you can point to that explains why you've been able to do this for 32 years?
I'm a little bit old school. What I learned at the very beginning is Kathy Collins, my manager who hired me at one time said, you know, do what you say you're going to do. So if you say you're going to be there at 5 o'clock on Friday, you'd be there at 5 o'clock on Friday. if you're going to give them the things that they need, then you give them those things. So I think that's real important to do and to follow up on that. I think looking professional as well as acting professional, the whole world has gotten very casual. And there are a lot of very casual brokers, you know, showing up and workout clothes and this and that. I don't do that. I mean, you'd be surprised. And I just think that represents who you are and how you act. And, you know, the respect for your client is that you wouldn't have time to go and at least present yourself a little bit better, regardless of how good a friend you are with that person or family member or whatever. I think there's just the diligence of following up. You know, and you know, there are choices that you have to make with, is it better for me as a broker? Is it better for the buyer? You always have to put the buyer or seller in first position, even though you want that sale and you want it as badly because you need to do whatever you need to do or pay your bills or whatever. You know, the right thing to do is to do the right thing for your client. And some people get mixed up with that sometimes. And I think that's in any industry. But I told people I didn't think this was the right house for them, even though that they wanted to buy it. I said, I would not buy it. I would not do it. You could make this decision on your own. But here are the reasons why, A, B, and C. You have the information. I think you're overpaying. Whatever the scenario is, there isn't a support for this comparable here. You're paying $25,000, $50,000 more. That's your choice. You give them that information that they need to make their decisions. And then you move forward with it.
That's amazing because you exactly anticipated my next question. I probably shouldn't even have to ask it now. Is, yeah, what do you do? I mean, given your expertise, when you have a buyer that is in love with a house and you don't think it's the right one, you think, like, based on what I know about you, based on what I know about this house, this is not the right transaction. And you feel comfortable telling them that.
Yeah, I tell people that all the time. I remember one client, I said, there is absolutely no way I would ever buy this house or let you buy this house or whatever. He goes, I love this house. I'm going to buy it. And they ended up buying it. And that's fine. But, you know, I give them my information and why. It's their decision, but you have to give them the right information to be able to make those decisions.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about this profession is that you're dealing with people who are making probably the biggest purchase of their lives. And that, I mean, this, as you say, can become a competitive situation. It can get very emotional. How do you deal with that on your side of it? How do you hold the room, as they say, you know, when things get really tense?
I don't know that they ever really get tense, as far as you just have to set their expectations at the beginning and know that this is how the market is. And you have to anticipate that you may not get this. And if you don't get it, it's not the end of the world. We will find another house. If you start with that, then you're able to find that right house. And I was even showing my niece a couple houses one time, and we kept losing out on houses, and she was getting so upset. And she goes, why doesn't this bother you? I go, we will find the right house, I will guarantee you. Well, it might have taken six houses again, but we found the right house for her, and she absolutely loved it more than any other house that they would have ended up with in the prior search that we had. So I try to set their expectations and warn them that we may not get this, but the right one will come along. And I know it sounds cliche, but it does happen.
When you get together with other realtors and you are sharing stories just about how crazy this business is, are there one or two stories that usually pop out that you use to say, I mean, this was as nuts as it ever got, a particular transaction?
Recently or just?
Total? Oh, anytime. Yeah.
Oh, I've got a couple of them, but I had a listing once that had a monkey and 10 dogs and a ferret and a guinea pig and a bird. And they couldn't understand why their house wasn't selling. And it was a house in a regular neighborhood and a subdivision that was on less than a half acre lot, you know, to have 10 dogs, 10 poodles and a sheepdog and a monkey and a ferret and a guinea pig. You know, it didn't necessarily smell like the best house in the world. That's one I always chuckle on. And recently I just had one house that, you know, I put on the market on a Friday, and we had 42 showings in one day. We had 15 offers. We sold for $100,000 over list. They ended up tearing the house down.
You're kidding me.
No.
Where was this? What neighborhood was this in?
This was in Carmel.
Whew. Did they say early on that's what they wanted to do, or did they just make that decision?
No, they were going to do some renovations. It was on a larger lot, so they were going to do some renovations, and they just were trying to make it work with the renovations and found that it's probably they would end up with a house with rooms that they didn't want or like, or the floor plan. It was probably just easier to be able to tear it down and start over, which probably was the smartest thing for them to do.
Let's say I'm a new realtor. I just started at Tucker. I am gung-ho about selling or helping clients buy and sell houses. Mm-hmm. And I run into you in the hallway. What is the number one piece of advice that you have to give me?
Well, I would probably tell you maybe to get a mentor or to get on a team to try to learn, depending upon how old you are and what your experience is, just to kind of understand the business a little bit. It's a little bit more cumbersome than when I first started. When I did first start, Tucker did have a program where they did have a mentorship, and that was very helpful to have somebody that you could go to and bounce questions off. Am I doing this the right way or the wrong way? Or how would you suggest to be able to do that? So I think being on a team is helpful. If you can do that, you're going to have to put in a lot of time. But I see that there's a lot of people that get ready to get ready, if that makes sense. So they're always preparing, but they're never doing. So you have to really be able to ask the hard questions and maybe you spend a little extra time showing 10 houses when you only wanted to show 5, but you do it and you make it work and you're doing it on the time that's not your time, that's their time, which is the evenings and the weekends and the early morning or whatever. You also have to make yourself set yourself aside from everybody else, which kind of takes me into a different avenue as far as how I think I set myself apart from the general real estate public. So I'll tell a little story that, so with Tucker, all our signs are very similar. So it's really hard to tell as you're driving by whose name's on the bottom. If Matt McLaughlin's name's on the bottom or Matt King's name's on the bottom or Susie Smith's name's on the bottom, just because you're driving by fast. And I had to find a way to try to make myself, because I do a lot of business in Washington Township, Carmel, kind of the north corridor from downtown. I always say it's kind of like a triangle. I go from downtown out to Zionsville through Westfield, Geist, and then back downtown on the east side. But let's say I do a lot in Washington Township. I sell more in Washington Township than any other broker. So if I'm in there, I have 4 or 5 listings at a time. You can't necessarily tell that I have 4 or 5 because our signs all look the same. And there was another person who had a different sign that kind of stuck out a little bit more that was my competitor. I thought, how am I going to stand out from them? So I developed this little house on the corner of my sign, which I put on there. It said Call Matt, which was more of, it started out more of as a quip, kind of like on a cartoon character. So, but it just didn't kind of look right on that. So we changed it to a little house there. So then all of a sudden, the 5 listings that I have pop up and everybody can see them driving by because it has something individual and different about it. So that helped me. It increased my business about 20% that next year because they could see that I had consistency. And now even today, when I have a listing in Zionsville or I have one at Geist or Carmel or wherever, people are like, you're everywhere. I see your signs everywhere, which they never would have seen that before had I not found a way to individualize myself. And a lot of people do that with their signs and, you know, if they're, you know, on a team and they have their team logo on their sign, they do it that way.
Is that something you had to clear with Tucker ahead of time and say, look, I want to put a sign on my sign?
I did have to clear and it was not. Well, I kind of did it. And then they came back and said, that doesn't fit into the guidelines. So they kind of changed the guidelines a little bit for the topper signs on there because they have to fit a certain size and angle and this and that. And I just said, well, at that point in time, I had the knowledge of how much it increased my business. And I said, I can't change it, we're going to have to modify it, your rules and regulations to be able to allow this.
My last question is the obvious one. How long are you going to keep doing this?
Well, I would see, since I got a late start in having a family, I got married at 34, 35, and then had kids after that. I have my youngest is a sophomore in high school. I have two in college, a junior and a senior, and then I have a sophomore in high school. My guess is I will probably be working for another 10 years. And then after that, who knows? You know, I'm kind of an all-in person, so I don't know that I could be a part-time person. My personality just doesn't lend itself for that. So I'll have to kind of wait and see. I like working with people. So, and I've made a lot of good friends through this industry and this business that I've spent a lot of time with and ended up traveling with and doing things with. So it's not a bad gig.
All right. Well, I'm glad you found something you enjoy.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us and so much of your career. It's been a joy.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
My thanks again to Matt McLaughlin. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest issue of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Indiana's tech sector is in a red-hot cycle of mergers and acquisitions, with momentum so strong that the number of deals during the first three quarters of 2021 has already eclipsed full year 2020 and 2019 totals, and by a healthy margin. Susan Orr examines the reasons behind the boom. Also in this week's issue, Emily Ketterer explains how state officials are working to preserve and grow Indiana's position as a leader in auto production by leaning heavily toward electric vehicles and related technology. And Dave Lindquist looks behind the curtain at the Indianapolis Opera to learn more about how it's shifting its strategy to be more flexible and to reach a wider range of patrons. Again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say, it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.